Welcome to Right Spokane Perspective with your host, Tim.
And Shannon.
It's opinion, fact, information, and your alert system. Stay tuned and enjoy the show. And welcome to Right Spokane Perspective. On this Tuesday episode, we are going to be talking with Representative Joe Schmick. He has survived another legislative session, and he's got some information for you, the listeners, on what Washington state government has done to and for you, the taxpayers and residents here in the wonderful state of Washington. We'll jump into that conversation after inspiration.
Our inspiration today is fruitful believers in Christ. Cindy was excited for a new job in a nonprofit company. What an opportunity to make a difference. She soon discovered her coworkers didn't share her enthusiasm. They mocked the company's mission and made excuses for their poor performance as they looked elsewhere for more lucrative positions. Cindy wished she'd never applied for this job. What looked great from afar was disappointing up close. This was Jesus' problem with the fig tree mentioned in today's story. It was early in the season, yet the tree's leaves signaled it might have early figs. Nope. The tree had sprouted leaves, but it hadn't yet produced fruit. Disappointed, Jesus cursed the tree. May no one ever eat fruit from you again. By the next morning, the tree had entirely withered. Christ once fasted 40 days, so he knew how to go without food. Cursing the fig tree was not about his appetite. It was an object lesson. The tree represented Israel, which had the trappings of true religion, but had lost the point. They were about to kill their Messiah, the Son of God. How more barren could they be? We may look good from afar, but Jesus comes near, looking for fruit that only his Spirit can produce. Our fruit need not be spectacular, but it must be supernatural, such as love, joy, and peace in hard times. Relying on the Spirit, we can bear fruit, even then for Jesus. Heavenly Father, please prune us so that we might bear more fruit. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Well, we need some pruning from time to time, and so does our state government. I think it's a tree that's gotten very out of control in its growth, and I'm not quite sure there was some pruning that was done, but we do want to talk to a man that sometimes wields the clippers if he can, and that's Representative Joe Schmick. He has survived another legislative session, is back in the studio with us today to talk about the legislative process, what happened to and for us this year in Olympia. Thanks for coming in.
I am glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to kind of hand the microphone over to you because we followed some of the stuff in the legislature this year and it drove me crazy. I could just, you know, shotgun method at every little issue and way we're spending more money. But I think that you had a front row seat to what our state legislature really worked on. I know that there was things you voted for because you had to on certain things and probably things you voted against that you would have liked to voted for if they had better intention.
Well, that's the way it kind of always is with legislation. Did you get enough for your constituents at home to be able to give a vote to it? So let me go over a couple things because I think there were some wins and we've got to look at the positives that we saw in the legislative session. Three of the six initiatives got public hearings and were passed. I mean, that's a win. And the fact that we've got three more going to the ballot to let the people decide, that's a win.
I think that's a win for the legislative process in a way, but I think it's a win for the citizens because I think the lawmakers that put those things into place that the citizens have not been happy with the last few years, like the Climate Commitment Act that's going to be on the ballot for us to vote on that the legislature didn't take action on. But when it comes to like the police pursuit where we could probably do a whole show on it. I know that you showed me a card earlier about the crime rates here in Washington, is that the citizens really want fundamental government actions like law enforcement and the justice system to do its job. And the politicians decided that wasn't the job of government. But a lot of these folks, your colleagues in the House, all of them and some in the Senate will be on the ballot. And they didn't want to be on the ballot with that initiative this year. So they passed it.
Well, that's true, but I think they've got to listen to their citizens, and I think the people want to have a place, their neighborhood, that's safe. And I that's just a fundamental function of government, like we were discussing earlier. People want to be safe in their neighborhoods.
people want to be safe. And of course, you've been on the healthcare committee for quite some time. They want to be healthy. And of course, safety and health, if we don't have those things, what else can we look forward to? So talk to us a little bit about the legislative process and some of the notes that you brought in from your endeavors there.
Well, I have a lot of notes, but that's mainly because there was a lot of things that went on. So we passed a supplemental operating budget. Now, there's some good stuff in this. We increased the levels for special education funding. We increased level funding for mental health for people with developmentally disabilities and nursing homes. And we didn't raise taxes for a change. Now, anybody's book, that's a win.
With the growth in our state government, you know, I looked at the budget. I think it was 2003. It was about $25 billion. Now our budget's like $72 billion. So the only thing that's grown faster than inflation in Washington is the size of government.
I would agree. 10 years ago, we were about $35 billion, and we're now bumped just over $70 billion.
Doubled the budget in 10 years. That's not a trajectory you can stay on. So it's a good thing that the legislature decided to not grow it too much in this supplemental budget.
Well, it did grow. You can't say it didn't. It did, but
well, and there was a piece in there. Here I go again. I'm going back to the news of the legislative session. In the supplemental budget, our governor put forward a lot of money to deal with the opioid crisis, and I noticed that in the wording, the language, that they were to track and monitor drug cartels, gangs, and drug trafficking. But I didn't see a lot there for actual enforcement, busting, and you know, methods of policing that, you know, our state government would support to really stop this scourge of crime because of the drugs in our community.
And I think that's an accurate statement. We didn't see anything. We had one bill that was going to increase sentences, and it died in committee, and that was it. But on the positive side, any state patrolman that has been in service for 26 years, we're going to give them a $10,000 bonus. A, to keep them on before they retire, because we're going to run into a real problem as more and more troopers are eligible to retire. We hope that this bump in pay will help them stay around. We've also funded a third class of Washington State troopers. We've had two. We're starting a third one, and we also bumped their pay. And
so this is about recruitment. Now,
recruitment and retention.
And retention. So we've talked about that on this show, about, you know, Washington State being the 51st state, you know, mm-hmm. if you include D.C. in the number of law enforcement. Of course, I travel across the state quite frequently, and you know, our state patrol officers see some of the things. You know, you drive by, you see lights, you don't know, you just get in the left lane and you pass. Those officers are facing tremendous challenges on the side of those highways. And of course, we just saw the loss of a state patrol officer just, you know, this last month.
Absolutely true. Anything we can do to help and support our law enforcement, I think we need to be doing. One thing that probably is not for the bigger schools, but for the smaller schools, there's a new construction grant program for modernization and improvements of small schools. And that money is sitting there, and so the small schools can apply for that and to do some modernization and some fix-ups in their schools, because oftentimes they get left behind from the bigger schools. And so we don't see a very equal monies going, especially to the smaller ones. And I think that's a big win.
I think that's a huge win for your constituents, too, because you're kind of a rural district. And
I've only got 10,000 square miles.
10,000 square miles.
Yeah.
And it's a rural district with a lower population. And of course, you're looking at a lot of farmland. You're looking at the taxable values when we're talking about levies and bonds, where that the McCleary decision really didn't get handled thoroughly in that way. And it sounds like the state legislature took some action in helping, at least on the bonding side, the modernization piece for those rural school districts.
And I think that's it. And for my small schools, yeah. It's a big win. I have close to 50 school districts in my district.
In your district. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
And of course, with the lines changing, I may have gained a couple, may have lost a couple, but there's still quite a few. And one other thing is I thought that was a good thing is that we developed a disaster relief program for those people that have lost their homes due to fires. Again, this is one of those, was it everything I wanted? No, I was a sponsor of that bill. I think Rep. Volz had that. And it got tweaked some to where it just wasn't as good as it could have been. But still, we're moving in a positive direction to offer some help.
Well, you're working in the minority. You've got a majority coalition that is going to be able to either kill a bill or pass a bill however they want. And at least you were able to get something in there. I know that when it came to the local fires that we had here in the Spokane region, there is huge problems that they were facing. And it looked like finally we did get FEMA to look at putting some money into disaster relief. And it also took our state taking action there as well.
So I think we're in that respect. That's a win, especially for those folks if they've lost their homes, devastated their lives. They could see some help coming from the state. Now, that's some of the highlights, some of the good things, and there's more. But let's talk about some of the things now that aren't so good. We still didn't change Medicaid reimbursement. And you say, well, why does that matter? Well, when we pay about a third of what private pays to pay a doctor, think of that long, skinny balloon. And what happens when you squeeze it someplace? It comes out someplace else. So every time we underpay a Medicaid reimbursement, it's a cost shift to private insurance and others. And that is why a lot of our medical system is so expensive, is the state's not paying their own weight.
Well, and it's really regressive. When we talk about Washington State and the progressive policies, most of them seem to be regressive. Our tax system's very regressive, and also the healthcare reimbursement issue is pretty regressive because, like you said, you squeeze the balloon, and then you have less doctors that want to take those.
The Medicaid patients, correct.
So then the Medicaid patients, though, those that are retired, oftentimes they worked their whole entire life paying taxes in the state, can't access a doctor, especially in the rural areas.
They would be covered by Medicare.
Right.
And Medicare does pay about double what Medicaid does. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the middle ground.
The middle ground.
And then you have the, on the high end is private insurance, and that's the one that's basically asked to carry the load.
So mostly your working class that are trying to someday retire are going to pay that extra cost that the state didn't pick up. Because you still have the inflation on I don't care where it is, if it's on medical supplies, if it's, you know, anywhere in the economy, there's those inflationary factors. So if Medicaid doesn't increase the rates, the cost for those doctors went up because they had to pay the secretary more. They had to pay the billing person more, all those things.
I was disappointed by that. I thought we had a real shot when we had some extra money. We could take care of this problem, but we didn't.
Next year.
We have to. This is not something that we can just keep kicking the ball and kicking the can down the road. We've got to deal with this issue. A couple of things that I'm seeing that trouble me, and it's the state overriding local government, saying this is what you're going to do. And there was even one bill that if a local community didn't follow what Department of Commerce wanted for their low-income housing, they were going to withhold tax money. Now, thank goodness that bill died. But I am seeing more and more the state coming in, well, our idea is better, and we're just going to override the local level. I totally disagree with this. The best government is the one that's closest to the people. And I don't like that trend.
No, I don't either. And I think that there's a lot of people that have seen that. And I want to dig more into this after we come back from the break on the Department of Commerce, because I know that one of the big frustrations across the state was the unfunded mandates from government agencies to the local governments, but also the kind of the top-down control in education where the state is making these mandates. And we saw that again this year, curriculum mandates on local jurisdictions when we want those local elected officials to work with our children and families on what they should and should not be learning in the classroom. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back again with Representative Joe Schmick. He is hailing out of the 9th Legislative District. I know that his district has changed because of redistricting, but you can go ahead and look him up on his legislative website. Again, Representative Joe Schmick. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening to Right Spokane Perspective. We are only on the air and podcast because you support this program, you the listeners. Please go to rightspokaneperspective.com, or you can send your donation to Right Spokane Perspective LLC, P.O. Box 7620-99207. Thanks, and back to the show. And welcome back to Right Spokane Perspective on this Tuesday episode. Yes, we have Representative Joe Schmick in the studio. The door is closed. He can't get out until the show's over. Actually, he's graced us with the drive that he takes into the studio. We appreciate his time because I know that he's been working hard for his constituents there in the 9th Legislative District over several, many long legislative sessions, as well as the really long special sessions that we've seen in the past decade or so. And I know that everybody's kind of relieved that we haven't seen a special session recently that was too costly, so that's good. But let's jump into some of these mandates coming from our state legislature and the agencies, because you mentioned something having to do with the Department of Commerce.
Well, and that just seems to be, that's where a lot of programs end up because we don't know where else to put them.
It's the catch-all.
Right. And that's why they end up there.
That's where, it's like homeless programs is commerce now.
Yeah. Well, they're handling the housing side of it. But I want to go back to that. One thing that the state knows better than the locals is around transit-oriented development. And that we're going to develop everything right close to all those transit centers, despite anything that local governments might have to say or the local people might have to say about that.
That's a limiting factor for local governments when they're talking about zoning and how they do their local infrastructure.
It is. And then some of the ideas that come around, that come along with this. There was one idea, and I don't recall if it passed or not. But if you were going to have development around a transit line, you were going to have to guarantee for 50 years that you were going to have a certain amount of percentage was going to be low-income housing. I mean, guaranteed. Well, with that guarantee, you just chased away any developer who was willing to go in there and make the investment to do that. We're not going to do that. It doesn't pencil out. But see, these are the type of ideas that we're seeing coming forward, and it's really not addressing the biggest issue of homelessness, and that's availability of land to build. The permitting is just a nightmare to get your permits to do this. So if you've got permitting, you've got the restriction of land. So we just don't have enough buildable spaces. All these things push housing up. And it's for everybody, not just low-income people, but everyone.
For everybody. Well, you got the urban growth boundaries. Yes. You've got all these different things that are controlling factors. And then, of course, who's going to make a long-term investment when they have a 10-year mandate or a 50-year mandate? When I'm trying to figure out who in Olympia's got the crystal ball. There's a lot of crystal balls over in Olympia, apparently, because 10 years from now, things change pretty rapidly sometimes.
I'm trying to figure out which developer has the line in on those properties so that they'll have the monopoly on it. You're talking about a crystal ball. We're talking about a 50-year commitment to say that you're going to maintain that.
A certain portion or percentage
who's
is going to be low income.
From that?
Well, and then what's the definition of low income? Because the one thing the legislature might do is they get to redefine what some of these things are, but you're still stuck with the mandate.
That, and also a property that may or may not be maintained.
Mm-hmm. Or maintainable. I mean, like you say, these bus lines, you're looking at your local STA. I call it the Spokane Taxing Authority, but that's just because of recent changes. But you look at changes, if they have a reduction in service because of financial realities, well, now you've got these developers on the hook for what?
Well, and now they're not servicing those areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just short-sighted.
Yeah, we got to have more
local control. I think there's better ways to go about.
Well, in local control, like you were talking about, the government that's closest to the people, even though government works slow, oftentimes it's really, really slow, but the larger, whether it's federal, state, local, the one that can pivot most quickly and make changes is that local government that has a meeting in your local area once a week or every couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
Where you can have the community come together and say, hey, we got to solve this. But if the state government says, no, we've got all these restrictions, there is no solution for the local folks.
An interesting, there's a community, and I forget the name of the community, but it's on the upper end of Lake Washington. That community had gotten together and said, we need to provide a place for our seniors to be able to have a lower income unit, you know, facility to be able to stay in the community and live. Okay. And that project was moving along, moving forward. The state got involved, and all of a sudden, well, that was for low income housing, not senior housing. And the community ended up pulling the plug on the project.
Wow. So now you got a bunch of our senior citizens that want to live in a community. They want to stay close to their great-grandchildren, yep, their grandchildren. And now they just got to find wherever they can find.
That's right, or they'll just have to move away. But that whole project went by the wayside. So here you had a local government trying to deal with the situation they had in their their local area and had a project that would work. And then the state comes and, we're not going to give you any money unless it's all low income. So it kind of superseded what the locals had planned, what they were doing. But I'm afraid that's becoming a bit more all too often.
It is too often. Well, I think it's that way also with law enforcement issues. I think the law enforcement has had their hands tied at the state level too many times in too many places, but our judges also are getting their hands tied. A lot of times we look at this justice system and the failures of it, and folks look at those, you know, frontline officers, why are you arresting this guy for the third time in my neighborhood? He's back again dealing drugs. You just arrested him last weekend. Why do we see this happening as citizens? And, you know, want to blame, okay, officers, why do you keep arresting them? Okay, now we're going to blame the judge. Well, the judge has guidelines they have to follow too. And, you know, where's the three strikes you're out if you're old enough to remember it, right?
Well, it's still there now, but we did remove one of the crimes from the three strikes that.
Was that just this year, one of them?
No, that was, I think, last year. But think about, here's the other side of that, Tim, is that what does that mean? That means that a lot of these people that had one of those crimes that was now decommissioned, so to speak, as a non-third strike, well, now the courts have to go back and resentence all of them. And that's a cost to the local government. You talked about mandates earlier. Mm-hmm. Well, here's a direct mandate.
So that's an unfunded mandate where our judicial system has to go back and do resentencing. Yes. And then you also have your public defender's office that seems to be underfunded at the local level, as well as the prosecutor's office. Both sides of the team seems to be underfunded. And then they have to relitigate these cases.
Yep.
And
resentence them.
And so that's a cost to the taxpayer because the state created a change in the law.
At the local level. Yeah. And there was no money associated with that.
Just an unfunded mandate.
Right.
And then our courts are backlogged. So now you've got these guys that are getting released, and then they've committed several more crimes before they go to hearing on the first crime they committed.
And we keep letting more and more people out earlier and earlier. I just don't think that this makes our community safer.
Well, I've talked to law enforcement a number of times, and they continually tell me it's the same small handful of people causing most of the crime. A lot of it is tied to drug use, and there's lots of different crimes that go with drug use, your property crime, your car theft, you know, the human trafficking. All of those things seem to be culminating around the immense profits that are being made on street drugs being sold. And they keep arresting those people over and over. They get released. And then, of course, the cartels and other groups out there just recruit more people. And we're not busting the source of the problem, it doesn't seem like.
And our current status of the judicial system, it's not a deterrent. It's not a deterrent. I think one of the main purposes of imprisonment is to keep our community safe. They keep these gentlemen and ladies, whoever, in behind bars that are a threat to our society.
Yeah, especially those guys that are out there. I remember on our show a couple years back, there was a guy who was arrested. His 222nd time, that's why it's easier to remember, it's 222, 222 arrests, you know, a laundry list of misdemeanors and felonies. And the criminals know, well, just don't have a deadly weapon and you're probably going to get released before the next week or whatever. And so we see the crime and property crime and all of this, the violent crime continue. And we don't see an end to it because we don't see the legislature taking action, telling the judges, hey, you have to do something to keep your communities. And it's important, I think, for rehabilitation. Some of these guys will just never stop committing crimes. They just need to be somewhere where they can keep them their hands to themselves, right? And their hands to their own property. But there's some people that could be rehabilitated and they're only getting sentences.
If they choose to be.
Well, their sentences are only long enough. Their sentences are more for recruiting purposes. Like they can recruit more criminal activity because they're only in jail long enough for recruitment, not rehabilitation.
I guess that's something I struggle with because someone's not going to be rehabilitated or want to change their ways until he or she decides this isn't working for me. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that, one of the ways is having a strong deterrent. I'm tired of being in prison. I don't want to be here anymore. And they make a decision, I'm not going to do this again.
A strong deterrent. Well, and it's just like the drug rehab programs. Most of these drug rehab programs that are outpatient, where there isn't really a whole lot of accountability, we're just supplementing one drug for another drug that's pharmaceutical, and they drop out of these programs left and right. There isn't programs that are long enough and have accountability.
Well, there's no accountability, right? You got to have people go through them all, and they are not long enough.
No. They need to be a year or multi-year, not just a couple weeks.
I think Dr. Raul Garcia, who's running for the Senate, talks about this and the scourge. And fentanyl is a scourge. It is. I don't know how else you can say it. It is a scourge to our society. But just to give this, if when they go into a secure detox where they're going to get, you know, off the drugs, if it's cocaine, meth, or heroin, it takes about 5 days and they're off. With fentanyl, it's a minimum of 7 to 8. That's just half again as much just to get that worked out of the system.
Just get worked out. Well, then they have to change their behaviors and their habits. When they get released, don't go back into the same streets with the same
people.
Yeah. So is there another aspect of this you want to cover? Because I know with the fentanyl, we could talk about this for a long time. I just watched Oppenheimer and the atom bombs that dropped. And the amount of people that died, it was a global event that killed hundreds of thousands of people. We look at history, how devastating that was. Fentanyl killed that many people in the last couple of years, too.
I know.
So it's a huge thing. It's like an atom bomb being dropped, a toxin, a chemical that's poisoning our communities, and we're not fighting back.
And it's tough here. This is a major destination for fentanyl here, and you can see it on our streets, and you can see it with the criminals.
We're a hub for human trafficking, drug trafficking.
And the reason why is because we don't hold anybody accountable. Our police are tired of going out and arresting people to see them released the next day still on fentanyl because they haven't been in there long enough to detox, right? So they're still going out. They're a menace to society. We can't hold on to our law enforcement. We can't recruit our law enforcement because nobody wants to work where there's no accountability. Why would you want to go to a job every single day where you're doing the very same thing
same
over and over and over and over again with no repercussions?
Well, and Washington is a hub. We are the largest, you know, population between Seattle and Minneapolis. And, you know, we're a hub for a lot of things. But, you know, one thing that people in the region do is they go across state lines to buy their gas over in Idaho. They don't do that to buy drugs because Idaho has much stiffer laws than Washington.
And again, it's a deterrent.
It is a deterrent. Well, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds of the show because I know you got a million more things to cover. So we're going to have you back. And, you know, maybe in a month or two, we'll get you back and cover more of these things. So just a parting shot for the audience.
I'm tired of how we make law-abiding gun owners the victims of more, or not the victims, but we're calling them criminals.
Oh, that's right. The Second Amendment, we did want to cover that. And it is actually pretty strong in our state constitution.
It is.
There is lawsuits going on right now with the current gubernatorial candidate who is in our attorney general's position because he is going after the federal firearms licenses and citizens, even in laws that have been struck down in California.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Well, you know, gun control is important. We need to use both hands and have our government maybe protect the streets so much more that we don't need to feel like we have to be armed all the time just to protect our property and our personhood. All right, thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it. All that being said, folks, we're going to be with you again tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Wright Spokane Perspective. We are sponsored by Wright Spokane Perspective LLC and made possible by advertisers you hear and contributions from listeners like you.